Hello, and welcome to Still Buffering, a cross-generational guide to the culture that made us. I am Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
This is... Hamilton Watch 2020.
Oh, whoa, I didn't know that was happening.
This is a surprise to everyone on the podcast except for myself. How is everyone feeling? At the time we're recording this, Hamilton, the musical, will be available on Disney Plus starting in 2 days, less than 48 hours. I personally cannot wait.
I'm excited.
Taylor?
I'm also excited.
Just checking in, making sure everyone's excited. That's really all the watch is. We're now about 2 days out, and I just want to make sure everyone was very excited.
Well, the next time we record, we will have had it available.
Next time we record, I would have watched it probably at least 7 times, one for every day of the week until we record.
We are planning, Tay, you'll appreciate this. We haven't told you this yet. We are planning to all watch it together and to make a cocktail themed for the event.
Yeah, the fancy cocktail they sell like in the lobby at the Broadway show.
Like nice. They might have had wine. I don't know if I had the cocktail.
I can't remember. It's called a Founder's Fizz.
Oh. I don't think I had it.
I couldn't tell you what's in it because I don't know alcohol, but I know that's what it's called.
I don't think I had. It's been so long ago.
I was going to say, I saw that with you, Riley, and I definitely, yeah. I was drinking wine. I was not drinking the cocktails.
Yeah.
Sometimes those cocktails at the Broadway shows, they're not shy about packing a punch. And if it's especially a show like Hamilton, which I want to relish every second of, I'm like, get the double size like Broadway cocktail.
It was also for me, I think was that the first Broadway show I went to?
Really?
Or no. Spider-Man was.
Oh, okay. All right.
That's a good first one. Yeah,
easy to confuse the two. I understand.
No, they're very similar. Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark and Hamilton, an American musical.
Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark was the first one I saw. And we did drink the Spider-Man cocktails.
There are a lot of green goblins, yes.
Of course you drank the Spider-Man cocktails at Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. There's no great like character scene work you need to stay vigilant for.
I remember, of course I wanted to stay, like, have complete control of my faculties to see Hamilton the first time because I had heard how great it was, of course, from Justin, who had already seen it, but I had not listened to any of the music or anything. I went in completely like
Taylor did,
you know,
too, I think,
clueless.
Yeah.
I wanted to just have the experience. But beyond that, I was also very intimidated. Like, I don't know, I didn't want to buy a drink because I wanted to like do it right,
yeah,
like be a proper Broadway theater goer.
Whereas with Spider-Man,
that felt a little looser to me.
Spider-Man, we sat in the fly zone, so we were constantly surrounded by various Spider-Men, and had just gone to Dylan's Candy Bar, so I remember I sat in the middle of you two, and we just passed back and forth the forbidden bag of candy that we brought into the theater.
Yeah, there was a lot of candy, there were a lot of bright green drinks, because that was definitely one where after we left, I was like, I don't know if that musical was really good, or if I was maybe drunk.
It
or maybe
great.
Both. I think it was both.
Both. Yeah, for sure.
I'll defend it forever. I think it was so much fun and I loved it. I have no problems with that. I will say, though, that I think Hamilton is better.
Yeah, I think we all agree on that. I think agree on that.
Shockingly. I know. I was reading the New York Times review of the Hamilton movie that we're all about to watch. And it was funny reading it. Like, because parts of it are just about how good Hamilton is, and it's kind of like, yeah, I mean,
yeah, we're aware.
Like, yes,
that's what everyone said when the musical happened. Yeah,
yeah, it is quite good. I did. We can all agree. You don't have to write that because we're all there. It's quite good.
I am. I'm glad that this is coming out to give a little boost to musical theater or theater in general. Because wow, it's a pretty hard knock to hear that Broadway is closed until January of next year.
Yeah, it is.
Which is the longest Broadway has ever been dark, I believe, which is just so sad.
Yeah.
It is sad, but it is a smart it is a good decision. It is a safe, smart, caring decision, as hard as it is.
I do hope, though, there are more Broadway shows that will maybe follow suit, because from what I understand from a few Broadway actors I follow on Twitter, it's pretty common for a Broadway show with the original cast to have a pro shot done, just to have in, you know, a secret vault somewhere. so maybe, I don't know, other Broadway shows will follow suit and you know, sell the rights to their pro shot.
I mean, I will tell you that we watched the SpongeBob the Musical that was shot on Nickelodeon live.
I have seen that too many times.
We watch that. Not quite daily, but almost daily. Almost in this daily. House. It's also excellent.
It is excellent. Yeah.
And I feel very, I don't know if I've said this on the show before, SpongeBob the Musical feels like there is a lot of queer culture in there.
Well, I mean, canonically, I guess SpongeBob is somewhere in the LGBTQ. There was a post that Nickelodeon put out saying Happy Pride on Twitter, and it had framed a bunch of their queer, like canonically queer characters, and SpongeBob was on there. Everyone was like, wait, SpongeBob?
If I remember correctly, like a long time ago, the creator said he was asexual.
Because I guess sponges are.
Because sponges are, yeah. I think, was the thing.
Apparently some sponges can sexually reproduce.
Huh.
After I read that, I looked it up to see, like, what was he trying to say about SpongeBob with this statement? What did he mean, asexual, or did he mean, like, the creature, a sponge? So I read about sponges for a while.
Hi, welcome to SpongeBob Ring. This is where we talk about the differences between sponges that sexually reproduce and asexually reproduce. Sydney, what species of sponge do you want to talk about today?
I can only deduce that he meant that SpongeBob is asexual, as in we are using it in the LGBTQ community. Asexual, yes.
So cool. All right. Like, I welcome our square-shaped brother.
Yeah.
Pride month has technically ended, but we can still celebrate SpongeBob. Yeah,
SpongeBob lives on in our hearts.
SpongeBob
and the Babadook.
Oh, the two queer icons of this generation.
But watch SpongeBob the Musical while you're at it. It's really good.
So, I know every word now.
That we're not going to talk about SpongeBob.
Or Hamilton.
No.
No, I mean, I am very excited about it.
Yeah.
I am very much looking forward to it.
Ooh, I guess this does open the door for us to talk about it in a future episode, though.
Yeah. We'll be the first people to ever discuss how great Hamilton is.
Absolutely.
That is uncharted territory. I don't know.
No, Tay, what are we talking about today? Because you're not talking about any of these things.
So as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, I wanted to talk about the movie Edward Scissorhands. Came out in 1990, I believe. It's directed by Tim Burton. It's still pretty popular in like the Hot Topic goth merch world, but was definitely in my day one of the things that, you know, Edward Scissorhands and The Crow and, you know, your staples of when you were a mall goth in the 90s. But also a movie that I very much love and I think holds a very special place in my heart.
Why do you think in particular this one?
You know, it's funny. I didn't know the backstory to it until I was doing some research, and it makes sense because I feel like everything behind it is what I was feeling from it without knowing it. Because Edward Scissorhands came from just actually a drawing that teenage Tim Burton did to kind of encapsulate how his feelings of like unable to connect to people and feeling isolated and like just, you know, like being kind of alone as a young teenager. Like he had this quote relating, like he did a drawing of this like, you know, thin, pale, like lonely, solemn figure that had these sharp blades for fingers to kind of represent his inability to like touch other people or reach other people. And he said, like, I get the feeling people just got this urge to want to leave me alone for some reason. I don't know exactly why. And I think that's what I related to in the movie, was just that idea of like, I don't have the ability to connect with people. Whatever port everybody else has, I don't have that. And I don't know why I was built different. And I felt very much that way as a teenager.
Do you think that reminds me, describing it like that way, that reminds me of you when you were young. Do you think, similarly to the painting that you did of, I would say also kind of a thin, pale figure, although not with sharp fingers, that mom hung in the living room?
That is still hung in the living room.
Do you think Tim Burton's mom hung that in the living room? That is my question.
I probably not. And I mean, that painting, it a lot to me. It encapsulated a lot of feelings of feeling lonely and sad and like a scary thing that nobody wanted to look at. But also, it's a scary painting. That mom has just so lovingly, like, hung it in like, you know, in every living room. And
yep,
like, I'm like, well,
I think it's beautiful. She is celebrating you exactly how you are.
I think it is also a beautiful painting, but I do find it entertaining when every once in a while, either Charlie or Cooper will like catch a glance of it. And they're like, okay.
Well, Cooper's still a little scared of it. I did think it was better once it was no longer hanging in the living room of their old house next to that big metal
naked lady
that mom used to have on the wall.
Yeah, the art in that room had a very much like to reference another Tim Burton movie, like, you know, the stepmom or the one that the dad's dating in Beetlejuice. She has all of her weird art that's kind of scary, and like that living room felt a little like that.
Yes.
And with that like old like floral pattern furniture that was all worn, and that naked metal lady, and then Tay's painting. It was all just like, it was an experience to walk into that living room.
It was an experience.
What happened to that naked metal lady?
I assume she's in your basement.
Oh, that's scary to think about.
The problem with the naked metal lady is that she wasn't facing you. She was facing away. And in my nightmares, there was a face on the other side of that metal that we never saw, but that was just staring at that wall and waiting. And I would see that in my nightmares a lot.
See, I don't know. There was some way in which my young brain perceived that piece that I saw because it's the back of her head with a long braid. But for some reason, I saw that as her face, and I just saw her as this weird, like, backwards monster. I don't know. There was, because that was in the house from the time I was very young. And I just, the way I would perceive it was like, well, that's her face. Her face is just covered in hair.
It's like an ink blot test. What do you see in the naked metal lady? What does that say about your psyche?
I don't know. I think we need to dig it out and like auction it off for charity, because
I think we do. We gotta go look in the basement when you get home alone in the dark. Go look in the basement for the naked metal lady.
I'll make Dad go with me
and find her, and please take a picture to share.
I will,
so that people know what in the world we're talking about. This has nothing to do with Edward Scissorhands.
But but you're right. That painting definitely, like, that was, I've had a lifelong obsession with monsters and scary things. And it's not because I like to be scared. I'm never really scared of them. I think that there's a weird kinship I've always felt, but it's never more encapsulated in Edward Scissorhands, where you have the kind of monstrous creature also be the sympathetic one. Because so often our monsters are kind of stand-ins for just people that we other in society because of something about them. So, you know.
It's definitely one of those movies that left a big imprint on me. I don't think as much in that personal way that it affected you, but from like a visual standpoint, it's hard to forget the imagery from that film. It's just, I mean, the contrast between the colors of the community, the houses and the people in it and their clothes and all of that, and then like the gothic mansion of Edward Scissorhands. And
man, that scene where he is carving the ice and the snow starts falling.
So beautiful.
I can, like, I first saw this movie at least a decade ago, if not longer. And I can always vividly remember that scene. Like, no matter how recently I've seen that movie, it's just like, it's very beautifully crafted.
Yeah. All of it is kind of yummy. Even the
wait,
the,
no, hold on.
It is. Even like the makeup that she has as an Avon lady, all of it is just like, I don't know. Yeah, it was just a little delicious for me.
Goopy pastels, looks like melted ice cream. I agree.
Mm-hmm. When I was reading about just, you know, kind of the history of the movie to like refresh my memory about all the other details other than just the film itself, I looked at some of the people who were considered for the role of Edward Scissorhands before it was cast. Tay, I don't know if you looked into this, but this really gave me a nice little giggle. So the studio really wanted Tom Cruise.
What?
Yes.
Which just no.
Which like I think all parties involved went, I get this maybe isn't.
Yeah. You know, that was probably just the feel in the 90s, like every studio wanted Tom Cruise for everything. It's like,
I think that was very much it.
It'll sell.
But there was another Tom.
There's another Tom that was also considered for the role.
Hanks?
That was Tom Hanks.
No.
who like chose not to do it.
Well, for good everybody's best friend Tom Hanks.
Can you imagine Tom Hanks in the makeup and the wig?
Professional
I just
buddy?
Can you imagine his face in that I can't.
No.
I know that's all I could I read that. I started laughing out loud and then all I could picture was Tom Hanks in the Edward Scissorhands makeup and the hands and the hair and the black with the like buckles and the collar around his neck and the whole deal, and I just couldn't stop laughing.
Yeah, I
that, trying to picture Tom Hanks in that way.
That would not have fit. I do. I mean, the costume of Edward Scissorhands, like, I get. There's a lot of costuming that makes that character, but you yes, gotta have the right person in that costume, I suppose.
And just a silent. Sad Tom Hanks.
That was just, I don't know. I'm trying to think of any role that Tom Hanks has ever done that's even approached something like that. Yeah. Oh,
I know.
Mean, a lot of Tim Burton movies. I mean, Beetlejuice. Can you imagine Tom Hanks as Beetlejuice?
I can imagine Tom Hanks as Beetlejuice a little bit easier than Edward Scissorhands.
Than Edward Scissorhands. Yeah. That's fair.
That is very true. No, well, it's just, I mean, Edward Scissorhands projects like isolation and like coldness and, you know, like being removed from society, and that is just not Tom Hanks. No. Who is like warm and safe and makes me feel better when he shows up. Not that I don't like Edward Scissorhands, but like Edward Scissorhands is supposed to make you a little nervous at first.
Yeah,
because he's got giant scissors on his hands,
right? Yeah. He did. I remember watching, I was very young when I watched this the first time, and it made me very nervous. I was like, that is not anything I want to get near, but I can appreciate it from afar.
And I kind of forgot how hard that costume went. Like, that is just leather and buckles and belts, and like, that is, I like that it's clearly just, this is aesthetically cool, because why, like, kindly old Vincent Price would put his, you know, handmade son in this weird leather, like, goth industrial fit, because you know, you get the evolution as to why he has scissors for hands. He was one of the robots in the factory that, you know, Vincent
oh
Price.
Is that why
I kind of, because I never really made that connection until I was rewatching it, and you see him, he looks at the little robot that's like slicing up the vegetables, and that robot has the same hands. So I that's what I'm thinking, is he kind of uses, he built a robot and then he started refining each part of it, but the I don't know. The intense leather daddy outfit is just like, well, that just looks cool. We can all agree it just looks cool, and it just leave looks it alone. Cool. And I'm fine with that.
Well, because like my assumption is that it is like part of him, since he is like not necessarily like, he's kind of humanoid.
Yeah.
That like, it's not like something you can like change, you know?
Right.
Like, I don't, he's one of the, he's like one of the dolls that my kids get, that they get really frustrated when they can't change the clothes on them.
Oh, and they like I don't know. Clothes. It's, yeah.
Yes. It's just like part of their skin. Yeah. I can't, it's fused with them permanently. Yeah. But that makes so much more sense. 'Cause one of my primary questions in this episode was going to be, why does kindly old Vincent Price give his son scissor hands before the real hand? Like, why is he like, well, I don't have hands built yet, I could leave, you know, I could leave nothing there, or I could put literally anything on earth there.
Scissors
very sharp multiple long scissors are my choice. And if that is the answer, that makes so much more sense.
I was kind of down with it just being like, I don't know, aesthetics, roll with it. But after rewatching it, I'm like, oh, okay. Because he like looks at the little machine that's chopping up the stuff, and then he holds the heart cookie up, and it's like, oh, he's gonna make a boy out of one of his robots.
Okay, that helps a lot, because that was always a question I had for the movie. Was like, a further question is like, at the moment where he holds up the hands to like indicate to the audience that clearly his intention was not to leave him with these scissor hands. Sure. He was supposed to get hands. At that moment when he holds up the hands and then like has a heart attack, I guess we can assume.
Yeah.
And then like Edward grabs at the hands and then slices them up with his scissor hands. I would also say that like the hands did not appear to be made of particularly strong stuff.
No, they seemed like sort of like a gelatin like substance, perhaps.
A Jello hand.
Yeah.
Which Jello hands would be worse, I feel like, than
Edward
scissor
Jello
hands.
Hand. Edward Jello hands.
Everything I touch goes, ooh, that's wiggly and cold.
It's kind of slimy.
That's a Shel Silverstein poem.
That definitely, that's the difference between Tim Burton aesthetic and Shel Silverstein.
Yeah,
Shel Silverstein wrote a poem about somebody who everything they touched turned to raspberry jello.
That's right. Yes, that is.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but no, that, and actually, in some ways, the idea of somebody walking towards you with big jello hands is somehow more upsetting.
I think I'd rather have someone walk towards me with scissor hands.
I know. Like, what are you? Don't touch me. They look clammy.
Because think about everything, like. If you think about Jell-O, everything sticks to it. Like, if you drop a piece of Jell-O on the ground, it's going to get, like, hair and dirt and dust on it. Like, can you imagine, like, Jell-O hands after, like 2 weeks?
Like, the hands, like, the little, like, sticky hands that you would get out of a machine that you would throw at a wall. Imagine if that was your Jell-O hands.
That would have, I mean, you could grab things, at least. That would be more useful than a scissor hand.
Yeah, that's true. That's true.
All right, Taylor, I know that there are more. there are deeper things we could say about Edward Scissorhands than Jell-O hands. But before we do that,
let's check the group message.
I always love the time of the week when I get to tell both of you and all of our listeners at home about my pants. Are you all excited to hear about my pants?
I've heard about your pants very often, but yeah, do it again.
You didn't woohoo, so my pants. I want to tell you about Beta Brand dress pant yoga pants, because I have been a big fan for a long time as somebody who goes quickly from like working out in the world. Well, not as much these days, but generally working out in the world in a job where I got to move a lot. I have to be able to like feel like my clothes aren't gonna wrinkle or get messed up every time I have to like kneel down to check out a patient's feet or, you know, check some reflexes or whatever. And then as soon as I get home, I'm tackled by children and I want to play with them, and I don't always necessarily have time to change, but I want to look professional and stylish at work. I want to be able to go out for a lunch or perhaps a drink or something after work and still look nice, and I also want to be comfortable when I come home and play with my kids. And Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants have me covered in all of those settings. They combine customer experiences with their expertise to make work wear that's as functional, comfortable, and as inspiring as your favorite workout gear. It's important to know they call them dress pant yoga pants. They are not yoga pants.
Yes.
They are dress pants that feel like they are yoga pants.
They are
because
as comfortable.
Exactly.
Yes.
They're that comfortable. They're wrinkle resistant, stretch knit fabric, and like I said, your long days at work or at home or at homework right now, work home, your home office,
work home,
work home,
work home where you are. Whatever you're doing, you're going to feel more comfortable, more professional, and you're going to like the way you look in your Beta Brand dress pant yoga pants. Taylor, if our listeners want to check these out, what should they do?
Well, right now, our listeners can get 25% off their first order if you go to betabrand.com/buffering. That's 25% off your first order for a limited time at betabrand.com/buffering. Find out why women are ditching typical work pants for Beta Brand's dress pant yoga pants. Go to betabrand.com/buffering for 25% off.
So, Taylor, you probably didn't mean for us to spend this much time talking about jelly hands or Jell-O hands.
I didn't know it would go in that direction. I mean, I kind of welcomed it for a while, and then it just got a little silly.
Yeah. Take us back.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, you know, the whatever reason, and I still agree that it's a little bit of a loose understanding as to why his hands are like that. I think it falls back on aesthetics, but also it's the central metaphor of the movie. Like, right. This is somebody that was born or that is different than the rest of society. And I think it's kind of the idea that he's got this thing about him that makes him scary and unable to touch people, like unable to connect with people like normal society, but he uses them to make art. Because that's the other thing, is Edward Scissorhands is an artist. Like, he starts with, you know, the bushes, and then it kind of, and this is on the rewatch, I didn't really think about this until I rewatched it, like, he kind of refines his art as he goes, which is so beautiful. Like, he starts on the bushes, and then he, like, does, like, the hair, like, the dog trimming, and, like, Styles' hair, then he gets to, like, the ice sculptures is kind of his final, you know, his greatest form of, or his greatest medium. And that's that progression of like, that's something else that I think is true for, I don't know, I think a lot of artists, writers can relate to that, where it's like, I can't connect to people like normal, so I have to find another way to do it. I have to find another way to say things and communicate, and that was his way of communicating something really beautiful.
That echoes one of the things I read that Carolyn Thompson, who wrote the screenplay, said about him, is that he, what was it? Her quote was something to the effect of, he is the most articulate person who can't put together a sentence I've ever met. Something to that effect. Yeah. And I think that was, I mean, in a very like good way. I mean, yeah. She said it in like a very loving way. They had a great collaboration. But I think, actually, I think the movie was called, like, her love letter to him.
Tim Burton.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, Tim Burton. Not, like, romantic, you know, just they like, they're friends. They're pals.
Yeah.
But anyway, point being that it was a way of speaking and communicating without being able to speak and communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a big theme throughout the movie. I know Johnny Depp watched a lot of Charlie Chaplin to help prepare.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah, to be able to communicate without words.
That makes sense.
You know,
wow.
How to send messages and convey emotion and to develop sympathy for the character, which is the thing that, like, the movie does so well, is you're rooting for him by the end.
Yeah,
you know, right. Edward Scissorhands, you want to be okay. You want to be accepted. You want people to stop harassing him, the little high school punk.
The worst.
Jim.
Right. Yeah, yeah, Jim. I do think it's really interesting, because I'd never thought about this in the times I'd watched it in the past, but I think in light of everything that's happening right now, with the protests and with the, you know, with Black Lives Matter and everything, I started to think about some of the things that cause the undoing of Edward Scissorhands, who is, I mean, he is much more supposed to be like more of a movie monster kind of outsider character. There's very clear like fairy tale elements to this, but just to kind of see it in light of current events. There's the scene where Joyce, who is trying to help him set up his own hairdressing salon, where she comes on to him. And when he is not interested, when he rejects her advances, she claims that he came on to her. And it was like, now I see that and I think this is a very clear theme of like the weaponization of a white woman's tears and you know, screams against someone who is considered an outsider, right, different by their community. And I had never really seen it that way before, but I watched that scene and I thought, yes, that is a perfect example of that. A way that we demonize this character who has done nothing wrong, and other him further than just his general being different already makes him other, you know?
Right. Well, and that's because he's never treated on the same level as the rest of the very homogenous community. You know, they'll take his art, they'll take what he can do for them, but as soon as he doesn't do what they want him to, or as soon as, you know, there's any inkling that he's a threat, it's like they turn against him so intensely. Like, it's very much like that's a narrative that I think fits a lot of the types of people we other in this world.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and because he's not in any way given the benefit of the doubt at any point other than in the very beginning when Peg, is that her name?
Yes.
Is that right?
Right.
The mom.
Yeah.
Where, yes. When she first finds him. And in that moment, you see that she's realizing, oh, he's not dangerous.
Yeah.
And like is kind in that moment, she gives him the benefit of the doubt. She lets him show that he is not in any way dangerous. His hands just look that way.
Yeah.
But throughout the rest of the film, people usually don't give him the benefit. I mean, because he accidentally injures Kim, and because he has and nobody ever even lets her explain or him explain or anything. It's just assumed. Okay, good. He's the monster. We needed him to be the monster because he looked like what we think a monster looks like, and now he is the monster, and the world is right because everything makes sense again, and we can, you know, drive him out of the town with pitchforks and torches.
Right. And he does the same thing to the younger brother, correct? Mm-hmm. Like, everyone thinks he injured him, but really he was saving him?
He was saving him. Yeah, he was about to get hit by a car driven by drunk Jim, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The real monster in the movie. I mean, the society that he's kind of goes into is all reveals themselves to be pretty monstrous, but Jim is the mm-hmm. quintessential like bad guy in the film. He's the one that he, you know, wants to break into his dad's house or his dad's safe to steal money, I guess, and coerces Edward to do it. And because Edward is in love maybe with Kim, likes Kim a lot, mm-hmm. and Kim is Jim's girlfriend, like agrees to do it. Which I thought it was like the fact that, you know, Kim said, like, you know, he knows what is happening. Like, he knows there's that moment where Kim kind of says, like, you know, Jim set you up, and Edward Scissorhands is like, I know. Like, he doesn't have, like, he understands what's going on around him, even if he can't engage. And I thought that was just kind of like, just because you don't read a person as understanding the situation, maybe they're just, you know, they communicate differently. But
yeah.
Well, Taylor, you had said this before we started recording, but I think you're right that you can draw some parallels to like him being neurodivergent and like people making assumptions about what he's feeling or thinking or what he's capable of because of that. Mm-hmm. I'm not like he's not diagnosed with that in the film, although he is. They do make the comment that he is not in touch with reality. He doesn't understand reality the way we do or something, which I think speaks to that. Like, well, you think differently, so I'm going to completely underestimate all of your abilities to do anything and treat you often kind of like a child.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's how it very much on the rewatch it read to me is like someone that has, you know, some sort of neurodivergency that the way that society just tends, like just to treat those people like they're not present. When it's like, no, that person is present. They're there. They're just there differently than you are. That doesn't take away their experience and their importance as a human life.
And a lot of the characters are guilty of kind of projecting what they want him to be for them or to them on him. You know, like the way that they want to see him is kind of the way he is shoved into different roles and here's what you can do for me and how you being this way can work to my benefit is a heavy theme for everybody in the community, whether they are. I think it's so interesting that you have like Jim, who's this character who is outwardly discriminatory and a jerk and clearly just hates him because he's different. You know, it's just out there. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to say it. You're different. I don't like that.
Yeah.
Done. And then you have lots of other characters who they don't say that, but they're, you know, it's kind of like the people who think like, well, I'm doing good because I would never use a slur and I'm not mean to anybody overtly. Mm-hmm. But like they already have their prejudices, their beliefs, their predispositions, and they will turn on Edward in, you know, in for a split sure. second, because they had all these assumptions they'd already made about him, even though they weren't saying them, you know?
Yeah. Which I think is interesting when you look at it on a broader scale, like Tim Burton movies as a whole, which I think you can find a lot of like recurring themes in them. But I think that is something you find a lot, whether it's, I mean, in Beetlejuice, you get a little bit of that, like kind of a sillier way in terms mm-hmm. of Beetlejuice's character. But if you look at like The Nightmare Before Christmas with Jack Skellington, The Corpse Bride with, I cannot remember the guy who ends up marrying the Corpse Bride, that character.
Is his name Vincent?
They're all these kind of, maybe?
Is it Vincent? Maybe I'm just thinking of overlapping things.
I cannot remember.
Go ahead. Sorry.
I just, Corpse Bride. But you get these characters that are either all the way on the spectrum of just being completely human or being half mm-hmm. human, like an Edward Scissorhands or like Jack Skellington, that are all some sort of other and different, whether it's in the way that they perceive other people, the way they look, the way they interact with the world. And they're all kind of, in a way, intended to look like the villain, even if they're not actually the real villain, which I think mm-hmm. kind of forces audiences, even if it's like a kid's movie or, you know, has a younger audience, to look at like, oh, the people who we would say are like the quote unquote normal people in this movie, or the people we probably most relate to, actually are the ones that are causing the problems in this movie, or are mm-hmm. the ones that are, you know, the bad guys, even if they don't look like it, which I think is really cool, because you wouldn't look at, just on the surface, movies like those as making some sort of broader statement about humanity, whether mm-hmm. it's because they're animated or they're characters or whatever. But I think they do.
No, I think they definitely do. I saw one description. They were talking about the way they modeled the town, and they talked about how the windows are slightly smaller than windows usually are mm-hmm. because they looked more paranoid that way.
Well, I would say that.
I thought that was a fascinating description.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Because then you have people clustered in them peering out.
Right. And the design of that, just like kind of all those pale pastel color, like every car is the same as the house. And it's just like, to think mm-hmm. of living in that town just seems like suffocation, you know? And then this beautiful mm-hmm. gothic weird castle on the hill, like he brings something new and different and exciting to what would otherwise just be this incredibly dull life. And like, I love the aesthetics of those two things against each other, but it also tells the story just in the set, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I read that a lot of people were shocked that they choose in the end to have Edward actually kill Jim. That was not a popular decision at first.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Because he did a bad thing,
yeah,
so to speak. But I think you almost have to justify why Edward has to disappear after that.
Yeah.
I mean, it was in self-defense, to be fair.
But I think that him disappearing is a very important, like, symbolic ending to mm-hmm. the movie, almost, where like you knew this society was never going to accept him and was never going to just let him be a part of their world,
mm-hmm.
but also you don't want to see him die. You want to see Jim die, you don't want to see Edward die, so you have to leave him kind of in this limbo where it's like you hope that he's still there being, you know, Edward and doing well, but also he has to do it somewhere else.
Well it snows every year.
Yeah. And I got the feeling from the end of the movie that they show the castle again, and you know, he's got all of the beautiful animal like plant sculptures in the yard, and here he is making his ice sculptures that he's okay. He's embraced his art. He's making his art like up in his castle, and the people that truly lost in this story are the townspeople that could have had access to something that gave them, mm-hmm. you know, a touch of beauty in their lives that, you know, and he still mm-hmm. in some way does with the snowfall. Like he still is giving them something magical, even if it's from a safe distance.
Which, you know, to take it from a very literal perspective, outside of all the other things you can read into it about society and the way we other people and, you know, ostracize people who are different. He's a filmmaker again.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, there he is. He has to be alone, removed from everyone else. He doesn't see the world the same way. He is different. But he's creating these beautiful things that you can see. Mm-hmm. You can't ever see him, but you can see the things that he makes with his you know.
Yeah.
Which I yeah.
With his abilities.
I mean, that's, and I remember very much, but like that was always my relationship when I was younger. And I think I didn't have as much of a thick skin as I've had to develop, but that desire to just like, I want to put it on the wall and then walk away. You can look at it, wait till I'm gone. Like, I did this for you, so you understand me, but I don't want to be here when you consume it.
Yeah. I mean, you've also got these, like, townspeople, though, that were horrible to him that still want the good stuff that he does. Mm-hmm. They still want his talent. They want to take advantage of, like, his skill and his kind person, but they don't want him. And they don't want to acknowledge that it is coming from someone they can't accept, which I think is a whole other level.
Which, again, is, I think, a comment on, like, the way we, like, consume art.
Mm-hmm.
We put ourselves into it and then judge it based on our own, you know, experiences and all that. And some of that can really disconnect it from the person who created it, because we're putting so much of ourselves into our interpretation of it.
Yeah.
And then we might need the person who created it to be a certain thing because that art has become such a part of us. Like, now we have all these expectations of the person who made it that are not necessarily fair, but it's what we need them to be to make our interpretation make sense.
Right.
Which is that must be a lot of pressure. I can't make art, so I don't know, Tay, but.
You make things. You're a writer.
You made a book.
I made a book.
Yeah.
With your own two hands. You bound it.
Oh, well, no. I
made the paper.
I did not make the paper. I didn't, but I assume that's Justin's next step.
Probably. Mm-hmm. With his woodworking.
With his woodworking that's taking over our house.
Is that like Justin saw hands? Instead of like
Justin saw
hands.
Like
his saws. Justin saw hands.
I love my husband, but he can never hold me because he has saws for hands.
He had hands. He just chose that this was easier for his woodworking. So
yeah,
yeah.
yeah.
Well, I appreciated you bringing it up, Tay, because it's a lovely movie, and I hadn't thought about it in a while.
Yeah, no, it's definitely. I don't know. Like, I think in the Tim Burton catalog, I think it still holds up as my favorite. There's a lot of those movies. I think his whole aesthetic shaped my aesthetic very strongly, but this is definitely one of the first ones I remember.
Yeah.
Well, I can definitely see those connections, and it's beautiful. It makes me want to. I don't think Charlie has ever seen Beetlejuice. She watches Beetlejuice the cartoon, the old animated series.
Yeah.
a ton.
How do you think she'd feel about Beetlejuice?
I don't know, because it's scarier.
Yeah,
like
has she seen The Corpse Bride? That might be a better place, like The Corpse Bride, or like I mean, obviously, I know she's seen Nightmare Before Christmas, right?
She has, but not all of it, because she got scared and didn't finish it. So she has never seen the whole thing.
Corpse Bride is, I think, always will be one of my favorite movies of all time. It is just so. So great.
Did he do Coraline? Was he involved with Coraline?
It's the same. It's one of the same producers, I think. But no, Tim Burton's not involved in it. I recently wrote.
Okay. I also thought this is.
That is. I rewatched that, and as an adult, I was like, "Oh, this is. I'm gonna be thinking about this tonight when I'm trying to sleep."
Yeah.
It scared the crap out of her. That's why I was gonna say, like, we made the mistake of watching that, and she was very disturbed.
Yeah.
By Coraline.
There's a lot going on in that movie.
And the other mother, and it was all it was all very hard.
Yeah, I would start with The Corpse Bride, because I think there are some scary moments in it, but it's definitely it's meant for kids.
All right. We'll go there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's also
I
was going to say Frankenweenie. That was one of his first shorts that he made, and then they remade it, I think, as an animated film not too long ago.
Yeah, they did.
That's a better place to start.
Yeah.
Yeah. Because I have to make up to her at some point for Coraline.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's a great movie, but it's terrifying.
Is that rain?
Yeah, it just started pouring here, so you can hear that in the background.
Wow. Well, listeners, in case you're wondering.
Yeah.
Wow.
I was relaxing here in Brooklyn.
I thought there was something wrong with our recording.
I did too. I was like, what's happening? Whoa. Something's about to explode.
So enjoy the rain.
No, it is it's just absolutely downpouring. I also think that this building is built on a weird slant, so like the back windows, it's literally just like water just pours off of them.
Wow. Well, with that note, enjoy that. Riley, what's next week?
So we talked about the show a little bit in our last episode, and it's a show that meant a lot to me growing up. One of my all-time favorite cartoons, and that is Adventure Time.
All right.
Yeah.
Yes.
It is a great cartoon. Sydney, Charlie will enjoy it. I think Cooper will as well, actually. Taylor, I know you've watched it. So,
you know, as I'm familiar with it, of course, I have never actually watched it.
Really?
What? Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, I think it has been on in rooms I've been in, like, yeah. I'm vaguely familiar, but I've never actually sat down and watched it.
It's a great show. I actually don't think I've talked about any cartoons or anything yet from my adolescence. So,
excellent. Well, then we will do that next.
All right.
And I'll watch cartoons with Charlie. Yeah. That'll be easier than showing them Tim Burton movies.
Yeah.
Cooper definitely wasn't ready for those yet. Although I don't know.
Cooper's kind of scary.
I was going to say, Cooper might be more down.
Yeah, you know.
Cooper would like him.
Yeah.
Although Charlie is the one who introduced that she has an imaginary friend yesterday.
Oh, no.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So.
That means you all are about to be the stars of like a horror movie, I think.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's usually how it starts.
Yeah, Coop. But I do find Cooper sitting alone in her room in the dark staring at the wall a lot.
Cooper is the imaginary friend.
Justin tried to do that joke for just a second with him.
Really?
He was like, you already have an imaginary friend, Charlie. You're always talking about Cooper, is it? Your sister? And I was like, no. I was at dinner. We were all sitting there at the dinner table. And I was like, no, we're not doing that. That is damaging to everyone in this room. That joke goes no farther. Charlie, your sister is real. She's sitting there. I could see her. And Cooper's just sitting there like wolfing down her mashed potatoes. Like, I don't know what you guys are talking about.
I don't know, but these mashed potatoes are great.
So I nipped that in the bud really fast.
Yeah, you don't want that taking root.
I don't want that narrative going down about their childhood. That will be in the books they write someday. Yeah. I don't want that. So
my parents convinced me that my sister wasn't real.
I think that's a theme in Frozen, so I don't want to.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, Taylor, for bringing this topic for us this week. This was good.
Thank
this
you
was
for
fun, and we'll do Adventure Time next week. That'll be fun.
Woo-hoo.
I'm very excited for an excuse to rewatch that again, because I rewatched Adventure Time twice, I think.
Yeah.
Well, thank you, listeners. I hope you are all staying safe, staying home as much as you can, wearing your masks when you go out in public, and washing your hands all the time, just constantly. Always be washing your hands. I'll work on it.
All right. What? Anyways.
Abby?
Never mind. Don't mind me. Thank you to Maximum Fun, the network that hosts our show. Go to MaximumFun.org for a lot of podcasts that you would love. You can email us at stillbuffering@MaximumFun.org. It works. We get your emails when you send them.
So. Oh, nice.
Yes, it works. So send them. I mean, if you want to, if you have something to say. At stillbuff is how you tweet at us, and you can do that too. And thank you to the Novellas for our theme song, Baby Change Your Mind.
This has been your cross-generational guide to the culture that made us. I am Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McRoy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
I am still buffering.
And I am too.
Okay.
I was trying to think about what my hands would be if they became something I did a lot.
Oh.
Like Justin Saw Hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like I'd just be Riley Phone Hands.
Just a phone for one hand and the switch on the other.
Yeah, that's accurate.
Mine would be the stethoscope.
That would be highly impractical for a doctor.
Taylor's would be coolest because Taylor's would be like
paintbrushes or markers.
Yeah, yeah. A stylus.
Much cooler.
Yeah. Mm.
Sydney podcast hands.
I started listening to Ono, Ross, and Carrie shortly after I broke my arm, and the doctor had told me I'd never walk again.
I couldn't get my book started.
I was lost, honestly.
I knew it was time to make a change.
There's something about Ono, Ross, and Carrie that you just can't get anywhere else.
They're thought leaders, discoverers, founders.
I'd call them heroes.
Ross and Carrie don't just report on fringe science, spirituality, and claims of the paranormal. They take part themselves.
They show up so you don't have to.
But you might find that you want to.
My arm is better. I can walk again.
I wrote an entire book this weekend. It's terrible, but I did it.
Just go to MaximumFun.org.
Thank you, Ross and Carrie.
Ono, Ross and Carrie is just a podcast. It doesn't do anything. It's just sounds you listen to in your ears. All these people are made up. Goodbye.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.